This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Back in late May of 2019, we had the 7th annual Pebblepalooza, which is organized by Lance Pierce, who is a magician out of Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Many of you may not know Lance because he's one of those underground guys, much like in a way that Roger Klaus was. And there are some other guys, too, who have kind of been underground that you don't really see a lot, but they really are the ones who are the backbone of the community as far as coming up with these groundbreaking ideas and things. And actually, that Lance has been around for quite a while and has been good friends with Roger Klaus, who was a big mentor for him, as well as with John Cornelius and Mike Skinner and others. And in fact, he was the one who had written the book on Roger Klaus in concert, and also the award-winning magic of John Cornelius. And he has been around for quite a while, but again, kind of slowly and quietly beneath the waves. And he also is the webmaster of the Magic Pebble, which if any of you are interested in card magic, you might be interested in pursuing that and looking that up and joining that forum. And as an outgrowth of the Magic Pebble, that's why they have this annual convention, which in a way is kind of like the 4F convention, but actually even smaller and much more intimate, and brings people from all over the world also that come to enjoy this in Dallas, Texas. And it is not necessarily an invitation only, but it is kind of a first come, first serve, and usually sells out very quickly whenever that the registration first goes up. And anyhow, you're going to really enjoy the podcast we have here with Lance Pierce today, because he has a lot of interesting stories to tell about these people who are giants and titans of our industry, upon whose shoulders he is now standing. So please welcome my guest, Mr. Lance Pierce, here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. And today I have with me someone I've been wanting to talk with for a long time. And here we are coming up. By the time this is posted, it'll either be on or around the 500th episode. So it's taken that long for me to actually corner this guy, because when he is known as an underground magician, you got to really dig pretty deep underground to find this guy sometimes, particularly in Texas, since they're the seventh flag over Oklahoma, over Texas, since they're from Oklahoma. I've got with me a fella who actually has been involved with magic since, gosh, he was under 10 years old, and is also someone who is a performer and creator. He is an author. He was the one who had written the book on Roger Klaus in concert. He produces DVDs and work with some other guys, has been inspired by Roger Klaus and Michael Skinner, and has continued to perform in corporate events and close-up, and has really exceeded and excelled in the art of close-up magic and sleight of hand. And what he's doing now is really giving back to the community, a lot like with this podcast, I feel like what I do from week to week is just kind of finding ways, you know, to kind of give back, because we have taken so much, you know, and enjoyed so much for so many years. And I say so many years because he has gray hair like me, although he's not as old as me, but he's been around for a while. And so please welcome my friend over here, Mr. Lance Pierce. Hey, Lance.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate that. I'm listening to you say all that, and I'm wondering if you're really aware of who you're sitting across from. But thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. You have been inspirational. You know, I mean, that as Roger and Mike Skinner have been to you, I know.
Yes.
And now, you first met Roger, mm-hmm. you know, at a TOM. Isn't that right? When you were one of the first TOM conventions you had attended?
It was actually, it was a convention in St. Joseph, Missouri.
Oh, was that one of those David Sandy things?
It was, exactly.
Okay.
And, you know, Di Vernon was there, Fawcett Ross was there, Charlie Miller was there.
Yeah.
John Carney performed at that one. I was very inexperienced at magic at that time. That was my very first magic convention.
For that one to be your first one is awesome.
I know.
when you think back at that.
I was just blown away. And I did not have the experience at that time to fully recognize the magnitude of these personalities. Mm-hmm. But I knew once I got there and saw what was happening that I really was in the presence of something that was beyond what I knew.
Something in somebody
yes.
who was really great.
Yes. As a matter of fact, Vernon lectured that weekend, and I was absolutely blown away by the ideas he was sharing and the thought that the methods behind the trick could be just as beautiful as the effects. Mm-hmm. And that really made an impression on me. But there was also a point during that weekend when somebody walked up to me and introduced himself to me. And he didn't wait for me to approach him. And it was Roger Klaus.
Okay.
And I think what probably got his attention was that I had been in the dealer's room and I had bypassed all the little packet tricks or stuff wrapped in foil or, you know, Ziploc bags, whatever. And the only thing I walked out of there with was about 20 decks of playing cards.
Uh-huh.
And for some reason, the sight of me walking through the dealer's room back, you know, into the hallway with all these decks cradled in my arm because I didn't have a bag to put them in, I think that caught his attention. So when I came back downstairs, he made it the point to walk up and ask, you know, who I was, what my interests were. And that started the friendship that lasted, you know, for the rest of our lives.
That's great. I mean, the fact that actually he had come up and approached you,
right.
who was a young fella just with some cards,
yeah.
that he recognized that, hey, he's going to really be using these cards rather than doing the latest Emerson West type of...
Yeah, or maybe he thought I was just odd. I don't know, you know. But for some reason, he walked up and he introduced himself to me, and he asked me about what my interests in magic were, and I said, primarily close-up. Mm-hmm. And he started talking to me about the value of close-up magic and how... you have the value of skill versus gimmicks or other props, things like that.
Right.
Skill, he made a particular point of telling me skill is something you always, always have with you. So mm-hmm. if you were caught in a situation where you had nothing on you and somebody said, show us a trick, you could always do some trick because you have your skill. So mm-hmm. even though I didn't know this man, he was trying to impress on me the idea of the value of those types of things over the easy paths.
Yeah.
You know?
Just something that's beyond just mm-hmm. the sleight or the trick itself, but actually what makes the trick, you know, mm-hmm. kind of beneath that.
Right, yeah. Hmm. This is the kind of guy he was. I mean, I saw him do that in the time that I knew him over the decades that followed. I saw him do that over and over again with people at conventions. I saw him take time out to help people that he didn't have to. Hours and hours at a time, just because somebody asked him one question about a trick, and he would mm-hmm. just help them to until they couldn't even absorb anymore, because he wanted that person to really fully understand the value of this idea or that idea, or to get a perspective into the whole construct of magic as a complex tapestry of thought and creativity.
When I think about some lessons learned from Roger, the first thing that always comes mm-hmm. to mind that I continue to pass on to mm-hmm. other people, and that is three separate things. Mm-hmm. Read, read, and read.
Yeah.
He said books, books, and books. Go out and read. You just need mm-hmm. to increase your knowledge through books.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, now you've got individual tricks and DVDs, and you can
right.
which were just this, you know, tricks we had before, but now you can download PDFs and whatever. My point is, and I still recommend for people to go and read. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a lot like, Lance, I'm thinking, I remember when Harry Potter movie mm-hmm. first came out. I'd
right.
read the books, and I was the theater was packed, and I was sitting with my wife, and there was another family, and I was happened to be seated next to a child
yeah.
who was probably about 12, 10 years old. Mm-hmm. But the point is that I asked him, I said, are you excited about the movie? And he said, yes, but he said, I don't think that I'll ever see Harry Potter the same in my mind anymore, because I have an idea in my mind of what he
right.
looks like,
yeah.
and now the actor will take the place of what my memory is of that.
Right.
And that's part of the problem that I see, like with some DVDs or instructions that you might take from somebody
mm-hmm.
else, because that's how you think it has to be done,
right.
and you then have that concept as opposed to reading something saying, go for an example.
Mm-hmm.
I remember sitting next to Bob Elliott at Fechter's one time, and Boris Wilde was teaching a move. It was, I think, his kiss count.
Mm-hmm.
And as he was doing it, I was doing it like the reverse method, or using some thumbs instead of fingers or something different. And I was showing Bob, and he said, well, you're doing something completely different, you know.
Yeah.
It was, so I'd kind of was inventing on the spot accidentally,
sure.
but because I was seeing it, but I was interpreting something differently,
mm-hmm.
you know. So anyhow, I just think that it's important that you read, because you will learn some concepts, just as Roger mm-hmm. told you, that you can carry on to someplace else, because right. you may not always have cards with you, or mm-hmm. anything for that matter. You know, yeah. and if you're a magician, as Jeff McBride would say, you know, you're a magician 24/7. You know, mm-hmm. that if they ask you, I mean, don't force it on it,
right.
people, but if they ask you,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah, the things you carry with you always are your knowledge and your experience and your skill. And
perfect.
If you have those, you it's hard to catch you unawares.
Yeah.
Right? Or totally unprepared. You can
right.
always do something. Right. And and you were talking a moment ago about movies versus books, and that I've fallen into that myself as well when trying to learn magic through different media.
Mm-hmm.
And where I think the visual media, like DVDs or downloads, they have a place and they are valuable.
No question.
There is a different kind of interpretation going on when you read something, because you're playing it out in your own head. And that visualization may be different than what you might get from a different medium. I've found that when I tend to read, I tend to envision something as, in my mind, as good as it can possibly look. Whereas when I'm watching a DVD, I just see what I see.
Right. You know?
So given the former, I tend to make better progress, because sometimes what I come up with or the end result of my efforts tends to be different but more personalized than the author probably had intended. Whereas if I watch a DVD, I tend to, not always, but I more strongly tend to just do it as I see it. And then it becomes harder to break out of that.
To unlearn what you have just
right, exactly.
been learning,
yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. So, yeah, they both have value, but they are qualitatively different, and they have different advantages and different hazards to them.
Yeah. What would you say, talking back about Roger, would have been one of the key things and elements that he taught you? I mean, you just mm-hmm. mentioned a few things, but, you know, what would be something that you would pass on that Roger had taught you that you try to teach others?
Well, the thing about Roger was he himself called it an artist's mind, because he said he got it from his mother, who was literally an artist. She was very talented at drawing and other types of artwork. So he was able to learn from her the value of details, because he saw when she was doing her work where just a few lines or a bit of shading could make a lot of difference in how the final piece looked.
Mm-hmm.
So when he went into his magic, he found out this, basically the same thing. And he learned this from Vern and then Charlie Miller and other people as well, that you can do a routine or something, or you can learn a piece, but by changing one little thing here, it can have effects throughout the whole thing that make it look subtly different. And if you stack one detail in there, then it might look a little different. But if you add a second detail in there, it might look a little different. And each detail does this minuscule piece, but the cumulative effect of, let's say, a dozen details can completely transform something. It's almost as if you're talking about the greater being the whole being greater than the sum of its parts.
Right.
If that makes any
synergistic,
sense.
Synergistic, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So so it's a cumulative effect of these minor little thoughts that manifest themselves in a way that is greater than you would expect. So that's why Roger was always known to, and various people have said this, he would think to the nth degree, because he knew that the more beneficial details you could lay in there, the more reward you would get out of them, far beyond what you think each individual detail would contribute.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. So he was really a master at finessing things, at taking something that was standard and finding little things about it that he could change or transform. And by the time he was through, it would look totally different, completely different.
Yeah.
But when you examined it piece by piece, you realize it really wasn't all that different in its basic construct.
Mm-hmm.
It was just all the details that he laid in there.
That's true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That created the overall effect.
Mm-hmm.
But what I always thought was amazing too, that he would share with us to say how that, well, there was 7 years of thought.
Right.
That went into this one little
yeah.
thing
mm-hmm.
that he is sharing with you. And that's what I think also, like yeah. Most magicians who are lecturing, or maybe not even lecturing, they're performing mm-hmm. and they don't want people stealing their ideas. Look
right.
look at Matt King, you know, he's and mm-hmm. others, you know, who served their time. And then someone mm-hmm. said, well, that's a good idea. That's a good line, or that's a
yeah.
nice trick. And then
mm-hmm.
people will steal it. Now,
yeah.
another book that you had written was about for John Cornelius. What
yes.
was the title of the book?
The Award-Winning Magic of John Cornelius.
There you go. And another gentleman who had left us far too early as well, just recently, And there was another guy who was a genius who mm-hmm. was, I'm sure, discouraged because of people stealing his ideas.
Oh, all the time. And he was so creative. But the minute he would put something out there, it was no longer his, right?
Almost immediately.
Almost immediately. But that's the way it works sometimes. It's just, and I don't like it, and I know you don't like it, but it's just kind of the way things are sometimes, as regrettable as it is.
Yeah.
But John was trying to make a living off the stuff, so it hurt him particularly more than, let's say, Roger, who you know, had other income
sure.
other than being a full-time performer.
Mm-hmm.
So when he put an idea out there, he didn't feel the same kind of ownership that John Cornelius did. Roger was all about sharing when John was trying
to
make a living, you know. So it was kind of, it really... those types of things would really hurt him. And now I felt for him when those things happened.
Yeah. Steve Dushek, you know, was
yeah,
another one as
same
well.
Thing. Or mm-hmm. anybody who's very creative and markets their material and their ideas, they immediately run into this. Immediately. Mm-hmm. Or you have performers who have some type of a revolutionary act, and there's magicians sitting in the second row with notepads in their hand
mm-hmm.
or their iPhones suddenly held at a certain angle on
right.
the cord. And I find that a very... it's not a very respectful thing to do, you know.
No, I remember.
What are you going to do?
There's not much you can do, particularly
yeah,
today, because
right.
it's worldwide.
I know.
Pandemic. I recall when Matt King, we'll talk about him again, mm-hmm. was working comedy clubs, and I saw him at a comedy club. I want to say in Columbus or someplace. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, there was someone who was taking notes mm-hmm. in the front row, and he noticed that, and he said, "What are you doing? You're stealing my babies." I'll
right.
never forget him saying that.
Yeah.
You know, don't be writing down my lines.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Because even those lines take hard work, you know,
sure.
a lot of thought. And those lines are, you know, and this is in my own experience, but where I would be doing routines at tables in some venue or something over a long period of time. And if you do that for a while, and I'm sure you've had the same experience, you recognize, I'm doing this routine, and at this one certain point in this routine, it's just not the way I want that moment to be. Something doesn't feel quite right mm-hmm. or it's not energetic enough. So you spend time trying to figure out a way to improve that or fix that or add energy
yep.
to it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times the solution is a particular line or even a particular word. But but they're not always immediately apparent what those lines or words should be. So you think about it for a month or 2 months or a year even,
mm-hmm.
and finally you arrive at it over trial and error and thinking about it, and now you've got this line, and somebody comes in and sees you do it, and they're doing it the next day, and you're like, it took me a year to come up with that,
right.
you know?
Yeah.
But it's just the way things are. So I don't let things like that bother me, but I do see where it hurts people I know, because they've got so much invested, and it is their livelihood.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, you got a good point there also, mm-hmm. as far as Lance trying to go and work on these things, is that mm-hmm. restaurant magicians, that's one of the big pluses or mm-hmm. perks, I think, of being a restaurant magician,
yeah.
is how that you're doing it time and time, you're doing it 20 times a night,
right.
and you'll find that right moment or line or whatever that mm-hmm. you need in order to make that more professional, you know, time
yeah.
after time.
Yeah, and you don't arrive at them easy. It takes work to get to them.
Right. And then after you do, you kind mm-hmm. of fall into that.
Yeah.
It's not really a rut, but it does mm-hmm. show the professionalism, because, the lecture, as we're talking here, we're at Pebble Palooza. Or is this called Pebble? What do we call it? Pebble Palooza.
Pebble
right?
Palooza,
yeah.
Yes.
We'll get to that in a minute.
Okay, all right.
But one of the speakers was David, how do you pronounce his last name?
Kariah.
Kariah.
Yeah.
David was saying that you can tell a professional because of the quality of the act, because obviously they have done that a lot, because mm-hmm. they have the timing, the lines, and everything down. Mm-hmm. Again, going back to Matt King or somebody who has done it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some routines that I have done and do in my act then now that I feel are more solid than some others. And that's
sure.
because I've got some new things I'm working on.
Right.
And I kind of feel that maybe the audience can tell that, oh, this mm-hmm. is really good, but this other one, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you want to overall get an act, obviously, mm-hmm. that is going to be solid, that everyone looks professional that
right.
you've done. And it feels, mm-hmm. there are some things I put in my hands that are natural.
Yeah.
One routine being Whit Hayden's four ring routine. When mm-hmm. I pick that up, I feel I can do it as good as Whit's. You know, I would hate to say that, but I really feel, you know, it is almost like a signature thing I love doing.
Yeah.
And I fall into the lines, the timing, and I've done it so many times. And I'm sure there are things, you know, like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what David was talking about, how
yeah.
that, you know, if you have done something well enough, mm-hmm. long enough, you're recognized as, you know, this guy's got it. That's it. I think
right.
the it factor, maybe,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah, and you know, you touched upon something, a quality of an act that a lot of people, I think, may overlook, because we talk about whether an act has escalation or whether it has punch or whether there's, the material is strong enough. But an act can also be seamless, where everything flows from beginning to end and there are no wobbles or there's no awkward moments that shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. But you don't start with an act that way. You only get there after doing an act 1,000, 2,000, or 10,000 times. And that's when it becomes seamless and has that smooth flow from beginning to end. And that's a quality that really makes a person look professional.
And unfortunately, there's not really a venue or venues where people can go and do these on a regular basis. The only thing that would be possible could be like a restaurant gig that you would have on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. But those are close-up things. You know, some people have an opportunity maybe to do some stand-up in restaurants from time to time, and they can do that over and over and have so many shows per night, and they could do that. Yeah. But that's the only place I can think of that, for the most part, people worldwide would have access to some regularity of learning, as opposed to just staying home in front of the mirror.
Well, this is why we talk about performers paying their dues, you know, because some performers, by the time they get to like where Matt King is, they've gone through 100 nightclubs, working 4 or 5 nights a week, four or five shows a night, and they're paying their dues by working hard and going through that grueling effort. But at the same time, they're honing what they have to perfection, and they're thinking about
it.
And you, I don't know that you can get to that top tier without running yourself knee-deep in the mud first. I don't know any other way to do it.
I think you have to. You know, that's called flight time. Obviously, you have, you need that flight time. And, but where do you get that? And that's what a lot of people will come to me to say, well, like, I'm the entertainment director for the Magic Island. You know, and now we haven't opened yet, but once that we do, I'm certain that I'm going to be – I mean, I've already – when it was first announced, I was getting, you know, three, four, or five – you know, people contact me day, you know, phones and texts, and that's fine. And I, you know, I've got a lot of friends, and I, and whether they're friends or not, I want to have good quality people. And the thing is, at the Island, just like at the House of Cards in Nashville or Chicago Magic Lounge, of course, the Magic Castle, where that you would have an opportunity to go and perform more of a stage act, you know, or a stand-up type of a thing, you can do it over and over several times a night, and you do get good. I was fortunate in which that I had worked at the Island for many years, living in Houston, and I was a regular, so I got the opportunity to be bad. And more importantly, I had a mentor with Scott Hollingsworth who was saying, you know, as my director, take charge of the stage. Don't be pacing back and forth. Be more direct. Cut out this line. Do this or that.
Exactly.
You know, 'cause he could sit back and you really need to have someone who has an objective viewpoint.
And he was helping you trim out the waste.
Yes.
And get closer to that seamless state, you know?
Right. Well, and again, that's what I'm saying, is that not everybody has that ability or know somebody or a location where they're going to be able then to...
Well, sure, but that's why not everybody makes it.
Well,
right.
So, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
For different reasons.
Speaking of which, this is as a real aside, having a little bit to do with what we're talking about, I had a conversation with somebody at a party recently. It was one of those things where that it came out that I was a magician, and that, of course, one of the first things sometimes people will say is, you can make a living at that, you know, and so I would say, yeah, you know, yes, and so what do you do? Well, I'm an engineer, and so my response is,
you can make a living at
that? And he says, well, yeah, why? And I said, well, there are so many of you and so few of us, I think we'd be in more demand, you know, just I don't know how you would... It's like, oh, he kind of wandered off. It's like, okay, well.
Nice. So how's that Dale Carnegie course working out for you?
Yeah, I'm influencing people to leave me alone. Don't book me. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mike Skinner. So obviously, I know Roger and Mike were really tight, and I assume that's kind of how you got to know Mike. I never met Mike in my whole life. I'd never been around him,
really?
never met him.
Oh, I wish you could have met him. He was a singular person. He loved magic. He lived and breathed magic from the moment he woke up until the moment he went to sleep.
Wow.
And he actually didn't sleep that much. I mean, you know, but...
He lived in Vegas, right?
Yes, he lived in Vegas. He worked for years at the Golden Nugget Casino in the Lily Langtrees restaurant there doing magic at the tables, as well as traveling around and making appearances whenever he was called to. But
you mean like corporate shows and trade shows hospitality suites?
Or celebrities would hire him after seeing him, things like the number of house parties. He also gave instruction from time to time on magic. And really a class act. He gave a lot of thought about what it means to be a true gentleman and made every effort to practice it every minute of the day. And it was, you could see it. You could see him... always consciously trying to do the right. For example, we're eating and a lady approaches the table. Michael, old fashioned, would stand up to greet her. You know,
sure.
Nobody does that anymore.
Out of respect, you should. Sure.
Just out of respect, he held to those values, holding doors open for people, things like this, complimenting people when it was, you know, warranted, or sometimes even when it just helped the flow of conversation. He would just let you know that he really appreciated you as a person.
And I remember, made you feel special.
Yes. And there was a friend of mine in Oklahoma City where I lived who one time went to visit Michael. My friend went to Las Vegas and made a point to see Michael perform in the restaurant. And when Michael found out that he had an interest in magic, Michael sat down after a shift ended and spent quite a lot of time just showing my friend routine after routine after routine. Because Michael, sometimes he's like a machine. He just kept going and going and going. But what was...
It's like trying to take a drink from a fire hydrant.
I know. But yeah, what was notable about this was when my friend got home about a week later, he got a postcard from Michael.
Wow.
Michael thanked him. Thank you for letting me share what I love with you. And I thought that was pretty classy
that
to do.
That goes beyond class. Oh, that is amazing.
Yeah. And that's just the kind of guy he was all the time, every day. Mm-hmm. But you could not stop him from doing magic. Sometimes when you have a session, Mike would just say, okay, we'll just all go around the table. You do a trick, we'll just go around the table and we'll just keep going until we don't go anymore.
Yeah.
And those would last 4, 5, 6 hours sometimes, you know.
Well, there is a famous story about Michael working at the Magic Castle, and he did, you know, the 4 shows a night and had a different show every show and every night. Is that true? Have you heard that?
Well, I wasn't there, but I did hear that Michael's plan was to do that, but the castle, partway through this, had to ask him to stop because people had found out. It got everywhere.
Yeah.
So he was drawing all the lines away from all the other shows. So he just had to do one set after that just to, you know, get everything back in rhythm in the castle. Now, I don't know how true that is, but I read that maybe 4 or 5 years ago somewhere.
In Genie or someplace?
Possibly. Or, I can't recall. But yeah, I do know that whether he did it or not, he was more than capable of it.
Had the ability.
I don't think I've ever met anybody in my life who had a greater foundation as far as the breadth of repertoire he did. And it didn't matter if it was a simple Boy Scout trick with matches or a sophisticated effect with playing cards and handkerchiefs or what, you know, a full mini act with these props.
Right.
Michael could do all of it with equal ease. And he was just wonderful about it, you know. And every time you sat down with him, it was always, you're guaranteed to see something that you hadn't seen him do before, because that's the kind of person he was.
Did you ever think about writing a book about him, and in collaboration with him?
It never came up.
Okay.
Not that I recall.
Just, since you did with Roger, I wondered, because Michael's got 2 books out, I think, The Magic of Michael Skinner. So I thought maybe there's much stuff as he had coming out, and perhaps after you had done Roger's, that he might have said, hey, you need to talk to Mike. And
yeah, I never solicited any project I've ever done.
Oh, they come to you.
Well, so far. You know?
Okay.
And that's not saying anything. I'm not saying that to brag or anything. I'm just saying I'm not the kind of guy to put myself out there like that.
Well, you have nice writing style. You and Stephen Minch both. I really admire his style.
Well, that's a compliment to put me in the same room with him. So I appreciate that. And I'm not sure it's really warranted. But and Stephen, I've met him. He's a wonderful guy with great sense of humor. But he's very, very smart, too.
Oh, yeah.
So I really appreciate that aspect of him. So he's another class act. I like him a lot.
I can't say that I've spent a lot of time with him. Perhaps that might be somebody in the future I can record a podcast with. But
it'd be worth your while if you can get it done. Yeah, he has a lot to say. And it's good stuff.
Well, I admire his writing, and I've got several of his books and everything. So, I think that would be worthwhile then, too. So John Cornelius had come to you. He'd solicited you and asked.
Actually, Louis Filanga came.
Oh, Filanga. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Louis who wrote the Michael Morris book? Did Michael write that and then just had Louis publish it?
You know, I'm not even sure, because there was a period of time. Right around the time John's book came out, I had actually been out of magic for a while. So
what were you doing during that period?
Trying to live my life.
Okay. I shouldn't know if you were whatever doing. You're an engineer.
I was an engineer.
They don't do well.
But so I lost touch with what books had come out during that time or who wrote what or anything like that. And it wasn't until about 2001 or two that John Mooring, who was at that time editor, for Magic Magazine, mm-hmm. asked Bill if he could do a cover story on him, and Bill said, that's fine, but nobody can write it but Lance. So Mooring had to call me, and Bill had to call me, and I had been out of Magic for a while, but I said, yeah, no problem. You know, I didn't care. But that's how Bill kind of pulled me back in. So it's been rolling ever since.
Speaking of Bill, I was thinking about Bill Malone, and you had worked for a while then in Bill's Magic Bar.
Yes.
Was the one in Boca, or the one?
Boca Raton.
Okay.
Yeah, Boca Resort and Hotel.
Malone's I heard that was Magic just Bar. A hard-working, I mean, you were doing a lot of magic.
It was very hard work, and it actually took a physical toll as well because it was such hard work, but it was a lot of fun, and every night was like a party. But it was, but don't be mistaken. It was also work. Even even while you're doing it, you had to maintain a certain pace and a certain level of energy. You had to make sure you're covering the room properly and that everybody was taken care of and you're not getting in anybody else's way, like the staff or the other magicians, because most of the nights had more than one magician working. So there was a lot of complex challenges involved. It was there was a learning curve. But as time went by, I enjoyed it more and more and more. And I think I probably learned more about magic and really about myself.
Like what?
Than during any other
period. What were your lessons?
Stuff I was capable of doing. Stuff, there were, when I first got there, I found it, me being naturally a shy person or somewhat reserved, even though I'd been doing magic for a while, it was still a challenge for me to, at least in this new environment, to walk up to tables and present myself the way I needed to, as opposed to just saying, hi, would you like to see some magic? You know, that kind of thing. You needed to walk up and boldly assert
in
that
their face.
Magic is going to happen here, and we're all going to have a good time. So there was a curve I had to overcome to get to that point.
And to become more extroverted.
Yes. But over time, you learn what you're capable of, and you learn how well you can handle other people. It was a very nice place, but every place has its share of difficult customers from time to time. So I had to manage those incidents as well and find nice ways to get through them and make sure everybody was happy at the end simply by doing magic in certain ways, right? Make sure everybody felt valued and all that kind of stuff. So there was some very interesting lessons involved, you know. But by the time my tenure there was over, because the resort had been bought out and the bar eventually had to close, by the time my time was over, I felt like I was a smarter, better, stronger person. You know, and I'm now, whether I'm in my regular work environment and I'm having to conduct a meeting with high-level managers in my organization, or whether I'm like at a gathering like this weekend with magicians, it does not bother me in the least to get up in front of a group or a crowd and speak off the top of my head.
It's given you confidence.
It's given me a level of confidence I didn't have before. Mm-hmm. It's given me the ability to talk to people in social settings that I didn't have before, like kind of like what we're doing now, to where things flow a lot better in these conversations for me. And I don't know if I can even articulate a lot of what I learned, but they were learned. Those lessons were there.
Right.
And like when I first started working there, I had been working in venues in Oklahoma City and other places for a while, in restaurants and other environments. And, you know, people seemed to like overall what I was doing and stuff like this. And when I got down to Boca Raton, it was a totally different level of feedback. If your stuff was not up to par, they had no problem either signaling to you or outright telling you that they were not impressed. So you had to take that into account and figure out how to get them impressed, because if you kept doing what you were doing, you would not make it there very long. So, and time after time, it was like, this routine that I've been doing for 20 years suddenly isn't working well for me, or this routine over here that I thought would be a solid piece isn't playing out the way I like. So, for example, my SpongeBalls routine, you know, and I've been doing this particular sequence for a long time, but when I got to Boca, it just absolutely would not work. And I had to reconstruct the thing from the ground up and solve all those problems. And I had a much better routine when I was done than what I came in with. Because I know now that it'll work pretty much anywhere.
And that was one of those things you probably learned a little at a time. It's like, okay, well, this works. But then you had to work on another part of it until you finally get the whole routine down. Yeah.
And sometimes it was a matter of changing a move or changing a moment, you know, to where something would happen and you would pause for this long, or you would pause for this long versus a shorter period of time, mm-hmm. because that makes a difference sometimes. Or mm-hmm. sometimes it makes the difference what you say at a certain critical time. So you have to figure all those things out. But by the time my time at the bar was done, that routine was a closer. And I could go walk up to the table, do a set, and close with the sponge balls and get screams, and mm-hmm. everybody would applaud. And I knew I had a good thing, a good piece. Yeah.
Did you feel that it was because of the level of sophistication difference between Boca and Oklahoma City, mm-hmm. Or the wealth?
I think the wealth was part of it, because people that frequented the resort tended to be on the much wealthier side, mm-hmm. Partly because of that, there's a cultural difference. They were more, they expected more of the people around them.
It wasn't that they didn't want to be fooled. It's just they had a higher level of expectation.
Okay. And I think some of them, just because of, depending on where they were from or what their life was like, for instance, but like a CEO of an organization demands a lot of everybody around him,
sure.
probably even in his personal life, just because that's what got him there in the first place, was mm-hmm. those expectations, those drives, those ambitions. So when you're a magician performing for somebody like that, and he's looking for what you're messing up on, he's watching to see if you're going to expose something that you're not supposed to, or if he can pierce your armor or whatever. So you've got to make your stuff as bulletproof as possible. But the thing, and so you're in this game dynamic where their game is to catch you, the magician, but they're only happy if they absolutely fail, which is a weird dynamic to be in. But I saw that play out over and over again, night after night after night. They were always on guard. They were telling other people, don't listen to what he says. Watch his hands. Watch his hands. That's where it is, you know? And then at the very end, when they can't catch you, only then are they impressed. When they fail at what they're doing, then they love you, you know.
Did you find sometimes that they were just even second-guessing you? It's like, open that hand, even though there was nothing there, whatever.
Once in a while, mm-hmm. you get those as well. Or you get the occasional grabber who grabs
yes.
your wrist or whatever.
Right.
And you've just got to get experienced enough to where, you know.
You don't let it bother you.
You don't let it bother you, or you can play it off as a joke. Or you can even somehow, and this is, I'm not sure how to explain this, but sometimes you can make it get to an instinctive level where you know what these people are going to do before they do. You ever been driving down the road and somebody comes along the lane next to you and you just know he's going to turn on his turn signal
sure.
5 seconds before he does it
sure.
and want to move over?
Of course.
It's the same thing at a table when you're doing close-up magic for some people. A lot of times you can tell several seconds before anything happens, this guy's going to say something, or this guy's going to reach for my arm, or this, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So given
same
that.
Same thing that's with a classic force.
You yes.
know, where that you're
yes,
going to be knowing
yeah.
exactly what they're going
right.
to be doing in their timing.
Yeah. And it feels like mind reading. It's not, but it's just you become so familiar with these rhythms and the dynamics of what's going on that a lot of times you know what's going to happen before it happens, because mm-hmm. you've been there so many times before. So when you feel that happening, when you know this guy's going to, he might not even know it himself that he's going to reach out and do something, but you already know it. So by the time it happens, you've already solved the problem. You've already gotten rid of what needed to be gotten rid of. You've already replaced the palm card or whatever you needed to do. You're ahead of them.
You're playing chess.
It feels like it to a certain extent.
Because you're several moves ahead.
It feels like it to a certain extent. Yeah.
Because they're not playing chess. They're playing checkers and you're playing chess.
Yeah. yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
you
right.
have to think
yeah.
differently, I believe, you know, than yeah. the spectator.
Yeah,
I was just thinking, the reason I mentioned about sophistication, because when I talked with David Stone some years ago, I had asked him, what is it you feel that you lack? And he said, confidence. And the reason, which surprised the heck out of me, because yeah. he seemed to be very confident, is because of working in places like Monte Carlo and, you know, different places for multi-wealthy gazillionaires, basically, in which they would call him over and say, hey, magic boy, go over here and give him €100 and say, stay away from my table. I don't want you near me. And it's just that he got that a lot of times, in which
yeah.
he was kind of, you know, got to have that Pavlov kind of conditioning where he was afraid to approach a table
yeah.
because they may not really want to see him. So he was lacking that confidence.
Yeah.
So did you experience some of that from the standpoint that people came, I assume, to yeah. Malone's Magic Bar to see magic as opposed to just going into?
Most of them, not all of them. But
okay.
Some of them were dragged there by their friends and things
okay.
like this. And but yes, there's a lot of that in play, no matter who you are. But knowing that in advance, I do believe there's ways you can stop that problem before it happens.
Like?
For example, let's say you're in a restaurant and you're the magician but you're not wearing a funny vest or rabbits or a top hat. You're just a guy in a business suit. So you walk up to the table, and this is a stupid line. It's really dumb. I know it is. But you walk up to a table and you say, how is everybody doing tonight? And they'll look at you, and they don't know who you are.
Maitre d'.
They know you're with the restaurant, and you're wearing a jacket and a tie. So you say, oh, everything is fine. Thank you. You're doing well. And you look at them for a second like something's not quite right, and you go, oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I apologize. Management has asked me to come out here, come up to as many tables as I can, and interrupt as many conversations as possible. How am I doing? And just saying that catches them so off guard, they go, you're doing great. And you say, well, since I'm already here, let's try this. And they're already smiling, and now they don't mind. But you've never walked up and said, would you like to see a magic trick? Because, and this is only me, this is my analysis, not a lot of people agree with it. You know, I've met people who thought differently, which is fine, because we all have our own experiences and our ways of doing things. But when I, in my mind, if people aren't familiar with magicians, the general impression they have is not always the most positive one, okay? Unless they've seen a magician before and they know what it can be like, then they tend to love it. But if they haven't ever seen a magician or had somebody work for them personally, like in close-up magic, they may have a negative impression of it. And so if you walk up and say, would you like to see a magic trick? More often than not, they're inclined to say, no, thanks. But they're saying no to something that they don't know what they're refusing. They're saying no to something in their mind that's not even accurate. So I prefer to walk up and just start doing magic for them under some pretext. I get them laughing first with a joke or something. And once I got them laughing, I just start into the trick and they're more receptive to it. And by the time I'm done with their first trick, they can't wait to see more.
Right.
Because you've gotten all around all those negative impressions. But if you ask them, they'll just say no thanks. And you're like, okay.
I think your opening line is very important. And, and since you shared that, then I will share one that Dan Garrett had given me a long time ago. Very similar, in which you walk up and say, excuse me, I'm a professional interrupter. How am I doing? I mean, he just jumps right into the joke.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they start laughing. Yeah. And then they say, and I also do magic. And
okay.
You kind of do something else.
Yeah.
So, that was a totally different experience, obviously, in working in that restaurant. Right. As I said, we were here then right now, actually, with Pebblepalooza. Mm-hmm. And this actually is something that's been going on for a long, the seventh year.
This is the seventh
four
year.
Of the years. Yes. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but years ago, whenever I used to come to this, initially it was Brian O'Neill's birthday bash. And then I think it was just called the birthday bash. Mm-hmm. And then it went to the Dallas Close Up. And then it was D Cup, and Bob White and other guys were involved with this. And then I think it kind of fell out for a while, and then you taking it over as Pebble, because it had a good location here in Dallas.
Not quite. Brian's close-up conventions, you know, there were it was a challenge for him to keep doing them, so he stopped doing them. And then Bob and some of his friends started doing what was called Super Session.
Super Session, that was it.
And that was a very it wasn't like a convention as much. It was like a bunch of guys just coming to hang out for a weekend. Mm-hmm. And the only expense was that everybody would pitch in maybe $20 to help pay for the meeting room. And that was it. And they would go for one day. And the only rule was everybody had to get up and do a trick, which was fun.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't it wasn't an imposition at all, you know. And then you get to see some guys do some great magic. And Roger Klaus went, and Eric DeCamps would attend a few, and a lot of the Dallas guys, Jared Koff and Brian O'Neill, and a lot of the, they just did, you'd see them do all this wonderful stuff. And then after Bob didn't want to put as much effort and energy into it, Tiny took it over, Jordan Burgess. Took it over, did it for a few years. And then I asked Tiny if I could do a parallel Super Session in Oklahoma City. He always did his in March. So I said, well, maybe I'll do mine in October or early November, 6 months away from it. And then it would be Super Session North. So I did that two or three years.
Did you get pretty good attendance? I never went to the one.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's hard to get people to come to Oklahoma City, but it was okay. You know, we had a good time. But at the same time, I had this online forum, which is called the Magic Pebble. So at that point, people were talking about, is there some way we can get together in real time? So we finally decided to pull the trigger and hold our own get together for the Magic Pebble, which is why it's called Pebblepalooza. So it's primarily for members of the Magic Pebble forum and any of their invited guests. So we added to our mailing list not only the people who are on the forum, but also the people who are on the Super Session mailing list, as well as anybody else any members would want to invite who they felt would fit in good with the crowd. And it's been Pebblepalooza ever since. Now, Tiny continued doing his Super Sessions for a few years. So you would have that in March and then Pebblepalooza in May. And then he got real busy with work and family life and raising his kids. So he just hasn't done Super Session the last few years. I hope he does them again soon. I think he's thinking about it.
Was it similar to this and about the same number of people, just a few?
Super Session was more like about 30 people.
Okay.
And, you know,
I think I may have attended one of those once, because that rings a bell of just being about a couple dozen of us kind of at a motel someplace.
Yeah, it was always a lot of fun. He would do it at the, he did it at the Fairfield Inn for a while, and then Super Session got a little big, so then they moved it to the Comfort Suites, which is down here on Beltline, just down the road from here. But it was always fun, and we even had guys flying in from Boston or other places to attend. And that's when you know you've got something special, when guys are just wanting to come hang, you know. And he would generally ask one person to speak and offer a presentation, but it was all very informal. And it was just a good deal for, you know, $30. And but because he was only asking $30, he couldn't do much as far as, it wasn't a convention. It was just a party.
Just
and
to get
$30 was just to cover the expenses of the party. And that's kind of how I approach Pebble Palooza. I've kind of drawn from that model a little bit. And I've drawn from what Dan Block in Buffalo was doing with his 52 get-together. And trying to get the best of all worlds into Pebble Palooza. Now, where I feel really blessed is with the Magic Pebble Forum, I already had access to a really great, fantastic, talented group of people who already wanted to get together and hang with each other in real time. And you know, the guys on the Pebble are like, they're known names, and they're talented, and they're excellent with sleight of hand, and they're good thinkers. So they were eager to have these, and we had the first one in Oklahoma City, but then I realized it would be easier on the attendees to just come to Dallas, and it'd be cheaper on them too. Plus, Dallas has a rich source of local magicians who could also attend that might not be able to make it to Oklahoma City. And that helped Pebble Palooza grow a little bit and become a little better. But it's not something I want to grow like into a convention. I want to. We want to keep it small and intimate. If it gets too big, we lose a lot of that appeal. The real appeal to Pebble Palooza is that, for one, pretty much everybody knows everybody. And everybody's friends, and they don't tend to bring their egos into the lobby. And when they sit and show card tricks, they're sitting and sharing ideas.
I find this to be very much like the 4F convention from the standpoint, obviously, it's all close
from the
up.
In the early days.
Precisely. I've been going for close to 40 years now. And you're right, back in the Forks Hotel in those days. My point being is, though, there is a lot more sessioning here for non-attendees, in which you encourage that. You know, I was talking with Josh Jay about Magi Fest, and he said, I really discourage people coming and hanging out in the lobby, because that, I feel, is part of the ambiance and part of what people pay for is in order to do that. And if you're just coming and hanging out and not paying, I feel like, you know, I should be charging for the sessioning, but you can't charge people for the lobby. But here, you're encouraging people. I mean, half the people who are here are not attendees, and they're just kind of hanging out and sessioning while the lectures and everything else is going on.
Yeah, and that, to me, that's fine. But, you know, and Josh Jay's is fine. I think they're both fine. He has, they're doing a different thing. They're doing an actual convention. And people will say, Pebble Palooza is a great convention. I always go, not a convention. You know, it's almost like a running gag, you know. It's more like,
how do you separate this or differentiate this from a convention?
I put this out there in my emails to the attendees and stuff. This is more like a house party, except my house isn't big enough. If I had the house that could do it, we would be doing it at my house. But we have to do it in a hotel just because of the logistics. But that's what it is. It's just a party. It's just everybody comes in and just hangs and has a good time. We didn't have to have speakers. You know, I took a poll on the forum one time. I said, do you guys want to have speakers? And then they, most of them came and said, yeah, we'd like to have speakers. I said, how many? Oh, we have 2 days to do this. How many speakers? They said four. So we have one speaker after lunch on the first day, after dinner, and the second day after lunch and after dinner. But the rest of the time is all hang time. All sessioning.
Or workshops, extra event direction costs.
Well, this is the first time we've ever done that.
Oh, is it? Okay, because I know Ben Earl's doing some stuff.
And it's something that, and nothing against Ben, and I think you'd understand because of what we're doing here. It's something I initially didn't want to do, but I wanted Ben to come, you know? So, and it's working out. I mean, we managed to fit all those pieces into the schedule. It doesn't seem to be interrupting or disrupting the whole rhythm of the thing. So everything's good. Everybody's benefiting, right?
This seems to be pretty laid back.
Oh, everything is very laid back. And, you know, it's like most years I get up and make the opening comments when everybody first comes into the room. And I somehow let everybody know that this is a real easygoing place. Everybody can cuss. Everybody can tell dirty jokes, whatever they want to do. Just be yourselves, mm-hmm. you know? And and so I'll might throw a couple of F-bombs out there just to set the tone. Not because I want to be crass, but just because I want everybody to relax and understand that it's okay. Mm-hmm. You know?
Everybody's so welcome.
Everybody's welcome, you know? We're not out to offend anybody or do anything, but everybody's going to be who they are.
On the other hand, whenever I'd ask you about whether that I could post this on the convention guide, for those of you who are listening to the podcast and go to the convention guide to see what's coming up, you were saying I'd rather not because, first of all, it's not a convention, as you were saying, and second of all, because it always sells out, and those people who are in the Pebble Forum usually attend, and if we open this up to too many, there'll be some other people who'll be coming who are really not part of the family, if you will.
And that's true. In the sense that if we were to open up to public announcements, it would become more like a convention, and it would start growing.
Yeah, because there are no dealers here, by the way. Of course,
no
nothing
dealers.
Like that. Yeah.
No dealers. Yeah, and
no evening shows or contests or any of stuff.
Nothing where we bring lay people. We don't do. Yeah, no contests. We don't give out any awards. I hand out trinkets. I hand out buttons and stuff.
I was
going to
say, I thought that was kind of funny. You don't even have a registration desk. I mean, when you show up, it's like, hey, I know you.
I know everybody.
You know who's paid and who hasn't. You know if you're welcome in here. And then you just kind of pass the buttons down in a big sack, and you kind of take one out. Okay, I paid.
So. Right. Well, the button's not even to show you paid. It's just a giveaway, you know?
Just an honor. Okay.
It's just a thing we do. And sometimes, some years we've had name tags made with lanyards and one time, weirdly enough, I gave out bookmarks because I had the money to I could print them up.
Yeah,
a Pebblepalooza bookmark. So every year it's something a little different. This year, Lauren Cohen, one of our regular attendees, she designed a nice lapel pin and just passed them out.
Those little magnetic things.
Yeah.
Which says the Pebble, by the way, that while we're onto this, and people might be asking, how can they subscribe or get on the online Pebble?
They would
forum.
Just go to themagicpebble.com. And read the instructions written there.
TheMagicPebble.com.
TheMagicPebble.com, exactly. And the basic outline of the process is, first off, it's kind of more of a pull process than a push process. It's not a process where people can easily come knocking on the door. Mm-hmm. They usually have to have somebody from the inside invite them to come in.
Right.
Not that the people can't come knocking, but one of the things they need to get in is a sponsor. Somebody from the inside has to sponsor them, basically vouch for them. Okay? Mm-hmm. The next thing they have to do is basically submit some type of an email of introduction. Here's who I am. Here's my interests in magic. Here's any accomplishments I have, things like that. Just so when the members see that email, they get a sense of who this person is and whether they might fit in with the group. And it's not to be elite, but we just want people to be able to come in and socialize well, you know, and not not cause any friction or anything like that. So that's why one thing we have our members invite people in, because then they're inviting people that they know will fit in, will
contribute.
Be like-minded.
Yes.
You know, and I don't even care if they contribute. People can lurk all day long. I just don't want them to start any dust-ups or arguments.
Well, that's kind of
like
what it is with the 4F, again, that it's by recommendation. You have to have two people who are going to write a letter of recommendation.
Yeah.
And that, so you're recommending someone who is going to be like-minded, just as you said, who is willing to share and everything, too.
Yeah.
You
that
mentioned
helps.
About having a wide variety of excellent magicians, you know, in Dallas, what we do, obviously in Houston, Texas in general,
yes,
in this area.
Texas is great.
It is. But I think it's amazing. I know in previous years that you've had others from Hawaii, and it seems like that, as far as Hawaii is, but it's easy to get from Dallas round trip quickly, I guess, in and out. I mean, Curtis Cam was one of the speakers last year, and then David, again, I can't pronounce his name. Was here today, and I noticed some other people, you know, who were there.
Curtis has been here every year. This is Alan Okawa's second time coming.
Mm-hmm. And Kanoa Harbottle.
Kanoa Harbottle, who actually lives in this area now.
Oh, he does now. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. But we've had people come in. The very first year we did this, the furthest guy who came in was from Korea. But we've had people, like right now downstairs, Eddie McCall is here from Scotland. And he's been wanting to come to this for a long time. And Now he's finally able to. And I'm so glad. I love Eddie to death. He's a great guy. Uh-huh. So it's just good to see that he was able to make it. Yeah.
But you're talking about other people who are experts. I mean, that are just, it's great to hang with them. I mean, and for the sharing that they have. Yeah. Howard Hamburg is always a great guy because he's willing to talk with everybody and share everything, much like Roger was when we talked about the coming full circle in this conversation. Obviously, Eric DeCamps and Bill Malone and some of the guys who are here who just are genuinely fun to hang with and willing to share and do whatever for as long, you know.
Yeah. It's a good group of people. And I don't, you know, and I've told them this before when I've been staying in front of the group. If I were to bring in a different group of people to the same event, it wouldn't be anywhere near the same. It's only as good as it is. These weekends are only as fabulous as they are because of who these people are.
And because of the synergy we talk about again, you know.
Exactly.
The sum is greater than the parts.
Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they'll come up and they'll thank me for doing this. And I'm like, I don't do this. I just set the hotel up because I couldn't do it without this group of guys. You know, this group of, I'm sorry, guys and ladies, you know.
Yeah. Are there any ladies who come this year?
There are a couple this year. Okay. And a young lady named Lauren Cohen has been attending every year for the past several years. Mm-hmm. Linda Hung is here this year. But we've always had various ladies drop in.
I mention that because I know that Shazampod.com, you know, that Carissa Hendricks and Kayla Drescher are both, you know, close-up people then as well. And, and they're always trying, you know, they're talking about trying to, you know, get more women into magic. And that there are quite a few. So I'm surprised we haven't had people like Suzanne and some others, you know, who have attended. But anyhow, hopefully we'll have more who become. And also, it does tend to fill up pretty quickly once that the word gets out.
Right.
Yeah. So you have to be kind of quick to to respond to get here. And if you can't, well, then you just kind of come and hang, you know, in the lobby.
Yeah, this time we sold out in 10 days. That was the fastest we've ever done it. But I have a feeling that it may be that way next year as well.
Why don't you take reservations in advance, maybe a year in advance? In other words, while you're here saying, hey, I'm going to come back next year, here's my money.
Every year I tell people, I don't know if I'm going to do it again next year.
There may not be an eighth.
Yeah. So yeah. I've had people wanting to give me their money for the following year. And I'm like, let's not do that because it may not happen. Then I'm in the position of having to give you your money back.
Yeah.
You know,
and I don't want to feel obligated to do this because I may not. Something, who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. I always end up doing it. I have always ended up doing it. But I always like to leave my options open.
Well, I think what's kind of cool is that, as you were saying, that you're really not doing a lot from the standpoint that there's no registration table or whatever. I mean, there are not a lot of documents. I mean, basically, you work out at the hotel and say, I need, you know, going to have X number of rooms and you have, you know, special hotel rate. But then also we're going to be needing this banquet room. But you don't provide for dinners or anything else or, you know, brown bags. I mean, this is, I said, nothing like any convention. This is why, you know, those, again, who are listening to this know that I also do convention reports and updates whenever I'm at a convention, but I'm not doing anything from this because this is, it's a party.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a convention, you know. And as you say, it's a family gathering and almost like an indoor picnic.
Yeah, yeah. That, well, I like that as well, you know.
Yeah.
And a few of the guys were talking yesterday about, well, if this isn't a convention, what is it? And this one guy goes, it's a hootenanny, you know. I said, I kind of like that.
That's right. Oh, we need a banjo player.
Yeah, I may use that one.
It's a pebble nanny,
right.
All righty. Well, listen, as we wrap up over here, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast. Mm-hmm. So I always like to conclude with asking, what is your philosophy of life? What is it that you live by? It's not necessarily a word, but a phrase or something that...
I have thought about this.
Okay.
I've seen a lot of lists of rules about, you know, how to live a good life. And I've seen a list. Here's the 10 rules you can do. Here's 5 rules. I have 3, okay? The first is always be kind.
Mm-hmm.
The second is never be cruel. And the third one is cut yourself some slack because once in a while you're going to fuck up even those two things. So those are my 3 rules. Beyond that, I don't really care about much about what people do with their lives as long as they're being nice to other people and not jacking things up for the people who live closest to them.
You have thought about this.
Yeah.
Those are good.
Yeah.
Lance, thanks very much for your time.
Well, no, thank you, sir. It was I was surprised and flattered and honored that you would even consider having me talk to you. I enjoy it. So thank you a lot. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. There's so many times that I get comments from listeners who are saying, you know, I didn't know who you were talking to. I never heard of this guy before, but I've made a new friend. because they cool. And they, I've learned a lot from somebody, and I hope that those people who are listening to this also feel the same way. So they now have a new friend in you, and they've also learned, because you had a lot of really great thoughts that you helped us with earlier. And also tell us a little bit of history about some of those who have gone on before, like Mike Skinner and John Cornelius and Roger Klaus that have passed on. And so you know, kind of letting this live out there in digital cyberspace, you know, from now on too.
You know, those guys that I grew up with, they're all gone now. Mm-hmm. And I miss them every day. I think about Roger. I think about Michael. And I don't know. The best thing I can do now is try to carry on in the best way I know how with what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what I'm trying. So,
yeah, well, you're doing a good job, and you're giving a lot back to Magic, and so I appreciate that.
All right, thanks a lot.
So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Lance Pierce. This is Scotty out. Well, thank you very much, Lance. I appreciate the conversation and the time that you took away from the convention, because I know as an organizer, there are still a lot of things to do, even though it seems like, as you say, that it kind of runs itself. It, no convention really does, and you're kind of the chief cook and bottle washer that does it all. And you did a great job here this year at Pebble, and look forward to future ones then as well. Well, I want to thank you, and I want to also thank all the listeners who come back week after week. And also, if you would like to know more about what's going on each week, you should subscribe to our pod letter, or which is our weekly newsletter, basically. And if you go to themagicwordpodcast.com, there you will see usually a little screen will pop up and it'll say join our newsletter or a pod letter. If not, then you can find where you can say subscribe to the Magic Word Podcast and follow that link over to the side tab. And with that, then you can find out who's going to be on from week to week, who's coming up next week, also suggestions from the archives. And if we have a contest, you're the first people to know about that then as well. So please consider joining the our newsletter, our pod letter list. It's easy, cheap, and free. Well, this podcast is being released today, August the 1st, and tomorrow on Friday the 2nd, I'm going to be heading out to Las Vegas and getting ready for Magic Live, and I'll be posting some daily updates from the convention beginning next Monday the 5th. The convention actually begins on Sunday the 4th, but there'll be, I'm sure, a lot of people who will be arriving early, and I'll be talking with them, plus there are some activities that happen Sunday evening, and I'll be chatting with a lot of folks then, and then posting activities on the next morning on the 5th, and then subsequently through the 8th, which will be then on Thursday, which will be the normal time when a podcast goes out, Thursday mornings, but you'll be getting daily updates. So if you can't be one of the 1,600 people who are going to be attending this massive convention in Las Vegas, at least you can kind of feel like that you are here by tuning in each day and hearing some of the activities and what's going on and my conversation with some of the talent, the dealers, the organizers, the registrants, and maybe even some of the people who are tangentially related to the convention. That is, that they might work on the casino showroom floor. And who knows who I'm going to get to talk to this time. It's always a lot of fun and a new experience. Hope that you're going to be enjoying that. So until next week, or at least for a few days from now, stay well, get booked, and remember, number one, always be kind. Number two, never be cruel. Number three, cut yourself some slack, because sometimes things just happen. This is Scotty out.